Headlines: Iran says an agreement reached with the U.S. for the exchange of prisoners is purely humanitarian. Israeli forces kill 3 Palestinians in Nablus. And North Korea test fires 2 strategic cruise missiles from a submarine. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumish Ahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has responded to Washington's surprise denial of reaching a prisoner swap deal with the Islamic Republic. Tehran's reaction came after the White House dismissed an old false for Iranian foreign minister announcement, a prisoner exchange agreement between Tehran and Washington. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said that Tehran regrets that the prisoner swap is completely humanitarian, which should not be politicized. Nasser Kanani added that an agreement on the prisoner swap with the U.S. was signed in March last year and via a liaison. Kanani said the U.S. government is not implemented for the deal so far under different pretexts. He said that indirect messages have been given, exchanged, and between the two sides to update the agreement. IRIB World Service News Awards for TV, radio, and social media production has praised this flagship news channels in Arabic, English, and Spanish for offering a new perspective to their audience worldwide. In a world where mainstream media sets the narrative,
creating a world where untold stories are told and unheard voices are heard. The annual IRIB World Service News Awards, dubbed Soap Media Festival, this year had a lot to celebrate.
It's been a few years that the dynamics are changing and the new world order is emerging. The unipolar world is now turning into a multipolar world. Iran is in a position where it can speed up this process and offer a third viewpoint different from the two narratives that have always existed.
Words that clarify the mission of IRIB World Service. And this is exactly why the Arabic news channel Al Alam swept the IRIB World Service News Awards, taking home wins in nearly every major category, with its sister channel Al Alam Syria TV maintaining frontrunner status with its popular talk show Zoom Room.
We are proud to be able to gain a strong foothold in Syria and West Asia in particular by shedding light on the truth and covering stories that are untold about people who have been misrepresented.
I've been with Al Alam for more than 8 years now. I have hosted many TV programs. It's great to be part of a team where the goal is to bring truth to light.
Meanwhile, the Spanish-language news channel Hispan TV, as well as Press TV, were seen as the gold standard of achievement in the television community, winning awards in different sections, including the Best Documentary and the Best News Website. Not to mention that Press TV's Palestine Declassified won the Best Political TV Show.
This is the moment we're in. We're in the end, the dying throes of U.S. hegemony. And as he was saying, I very much agree with, the cultural infrastructure for the ending of hegemony has to be put in place, and that involves media, including news and journalism, which can give a different view of how the world is operating and tell more of the truth about the world. So, you know, the media play a central, important role in all that.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, who has covered the most difficult news stories, including the Rohingya crisis and the developments in Ukraine over the past year, was not left out.
I think two of my heroes, Noam Chomsky and John Pilger, said that there's they've never seen as much propaganda in the war in Ukraine than in any war that they've reported on or written about. And they've reported right back from Vietnam. So that's telling you a lot. And there's a huge amount of propaganda on Ukraine. Indeed, Ukraine is it's a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And I think you're seeing the beginning of this split between the West and the East, China, Russia, Iran, and we're seeing a challenge to American hegemony and indeed the creation of this new multipolar world.
And according to the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB World Service is at the forefront of this propaganda war.
In this unequal war, where IRIB World Service has none of the advantages of mainstream media, from state-of-the-art technology to political support, it has been able to blaze a new trail. The fact that its news channels are frequently banned on different social media platforms is testimony to that. Meanwhile, this also proves in practice that the free flow of information and free speech are nothing more than slogans that are used as political tools by advocates of democracy.
Media play a key role in today's world. They can set the tone for diplomatic endeavors, and they are a tool of international communication. Particularly for the Islamic Republic of Iran, its media outlet can pave the way for diplomacy.
That is why there are great expectations, which means that so far, IRIB World Service has been able to deliver on its responsibilities.
In a world where mainstream media is setting the narrative, IRIB World Service has been able to break the monopoly and offer a new perspective. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Israeli forces have shot dead three more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. This brings to 82 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli soldiers and settlers in 2023. Our correspondent in Ramallah has more.
Israeli soldiers from the Golani Brigade had deployed near the Israeli military checkpoint of Surra, West Nablus, when there had been clashes between Palestinian fighters there and the Israeli soldiers at that area. They claimed that Palestinian fighters opened fire at Israeli soldiers and a military position there. And then the Israeli forces succeeded to murder three Palestinian fighters and wounded a fourth and had taken him for investigation. The identity of the four Palestinians, including the three who had been killed, had not been revealed yet. The Palestinian Ministry of Health didn't confirm if it's true three Palestinians had been killed or not. This is an Israeli military statement who confirmed that the Israeli soldiers killed the three Palestinians this morning near Nablus and wounded and arrested a fourth Palestinian there. Anyways, the Palestinians in the city of Nablus had declared a day of mourning there and a general strike, but the identity of the four Palestinians had not been revealed yet.
Saudi Arabia has reportedly refused to give visas to an Israeli delegation invited to attend a UN conference on tourism. A report says that the UN World Tourism Organization had invited the Israeli delegation along with representatives from 22 countries for a two-day event in the Saudi city of Al Ula. But the Israelis were denied visas despite an appeal by the UN officials in their requests for equal treatment of the organization's members. The development comes as Israel has been trying hard to normalize ties with Saudi Arabia. Over the past years, some Arab states agreed to normalize ties with Israel, but Riyadh failed to follow suit. Instead, there will be ties with Tel Aviv until the establishment of the State of Palestine. And North Korea has fired two strategic cruise missiles from a submarine, striking an underwater target. The missiles were reportedly fired from waters off the country's east coast early on Sunday. The missiles traveled some 1,500 kilometers before hitting their mock targets. Meanwhile, South Korea Joint Chiefs of Staff says military was on high alert and that the country's intelligence agency was working with its U.S. counterpart to analyze the specifics of the launch. The development comes against the backdrop of growing tensions with the Korean Peninsula over Pyongyang's repeated missile tests, as well as the United States' joint war games in Russia. Now to the war in Ukraine. Both Kiev and Moscow claim to have inflicted significant casualties on each other's side in eastern Donbass. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says over 1,100 Russian troops have been killed in less than a week of fighting near the city of Bakhmut. The city has been a flashpoint of the war for weeks, with Russian forces trying to capture it. Russia also says Ukrainian forces have suffered heavy losses in Donetsk in the last 24 hours. It says that more than 220 Ukrainian service members have been killed since Sunday. Donetsk, together with Lugansk, constitute the larger region of Donetsk, which has been the front line of the war since its beginning in February the last. The BBC's row with sports presenter Gary Lineker has quickly spiraled into a crisis, as the state-funded broadcaster says. Lineker was suspended from the BBC after criticizing the government's immigration policy. Earlier, we delved into the matter deeper, and we discussed this issue.
Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. The BBC's Director General says he will not resign after a backlash to the removal of Gary Lineker, the popular host of the broadcaster's Cornerstone soccer programme. Tim Davies says the situation should be resolved calmly. Lineker was suspended after accusing the UK government of using Nazi-era rhetoric in its new immigration policy. His ouster set off a staff boycott, which forced the BBC to curtail major portions of its weekend sports coverage. Many politicians and public figures slammed the BBC's move, accusing the state-funded broadcaster of buckling to demands from the ruling Conservatives. Joining us for more on that is Robert Carter, our correspondent in the British capital, London. And also we have Fra Hughes, who is a journalist and author and activist from Belfast. Gentlemen, welcome. Robert, if I could start with you. What's the latest that you're hearing there? Lineker, as I understand, he's not a news anchor, he's a sports presenter. As I understand it, he has more freedom to express political views. So why the heavy government backlash?
Basically, Gary Lineker has no business getting involved in politics, as far as I'm concerned. He's paid by the BBC huge sums of money to basically talk about a ball being kicked up and down a pitch. However, we found that on occasions which suited the BBC, he was given total freedom to espouse any kind of political rhetoric and propaganda that he saw fit. And of course, Gary Lineker identifies and comes from a very liberal sort of left-wing position. You could even describe him as being a bit woke, this kind of trend coming out of the West, where he has a kind of God-given right to virtue signal and lecture others, particularly from the Muslim and Arab world, about human rights abuses and how they should be treating people better, and how footballing competitions should never have been allowed to be hosted in Muslim countries, that type of thing, which we saw throughout the World Cup.
So Robert noted that the UK state broadcaster, the BBC, welcomed or didn't say anything, nor did the government when Lineker expressed views over alleged human rights accusations.
I think what we're looking at here is political censorship. You need to separate out whether or not Gary Lineker has the right as an individual in society to the freedom of speech, the right to use social media in order to put out his own political opinion or his own kind of moral objections to what the government of the day is doing. It's very true that other presenters, such as Neil Andrews and Alan Sugar, have made political derogatory remarks before on their social media without any sanction whatsoever. So this appears to be specifically targeted against Gary Lineker because he's speaking out against governmental public policy, which comes down to, you know, the civil rights of the individual to speak out against the government and power of the day. And I was just doing a tiny wee bit of research there earlier, and apparently there is a statue outside BBC headquarters in London. It's a statue to commemorate George Orwell, who wrote 1984, which is very symbolic, but that happens to be outside. He was a presenter for the BBC, and there's a plaque on the wall beside the BBC statue that celebrates George Orwell, and it says, "If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear." So I suppose the question for the BBC is, does Gary Lineker have the right to tell people in power what they do not want to hear?
Thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guest. Robert Carter is our correspondent in London. Robert, thank you. Fro Hughes is a journalist, author and activist. Fro, thank you as well. From Belfast, that brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The German authorities have searched a ship thought to have possibly transported explosives tied to the Nord Stream pipeline explosions, the German prosecutor's office said on Wednesday, 8th of March. The announcement came following media reports indicating pro-Ukrainian groups may have been responsible for the blasts. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The underwater bombing of the Nord Stream gas pipelines last September was carried out by a team of divers operating from a 15-metre chartered yacht called the Andromeda. according to a new report. The report in the German magazine Der Spiegel traces the Andromeda's route around the Baltic from its home marina in Rostock on 6th of September to the German island of Rügen, and then finally to the Danish island of Kristianså, close to the site of the blast on 26th of September. Experts have questioned whether the amount of explosives used in the sabotage attacks, estimated to be several hundred kilograms of explosives, as well as with the necessary breathing apparatus and other equipment, could have been carried on such a small boat, raising the question of whether another vessel was involved. The German magazine Der Spiegel said that one of the six-person crew on the Andromeda was using a forged Bulgarian passport, but the German investigators have yet to identify the nationality of the bombers or attribute responsibility to any government. A New York Times report this week cited intelligence sources as saying a pro-Ukrainian group was involved, but German authorities have warned about the possibility of a false flag operation in which misleading clues are left deliberately to point in the wrong direction. The Ukrainian government has denied any involvement in the attack on the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines, which were built to transport natural gas from Russia to Germany, and are majority-owned by the Russian state-owned company Gazprom. They were not operational at the time of the attack, which came 7 months after the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. But they were filled with natural gas, which bubbled to the surface, creating a wide area of visible turbulence. The German magazine Der Spiegel quotes a harbourmaster in Rügen Island as saying the group that hired the Andromeda were dressed like normal sailors, and that he saw them carrying shopping bags of provisions to the boat, speaking a language that sounded Polish or Czech to him. He said there were several men and a woman. The Andromeda is a Bavaria C-50, a sailing boat made by German company Bavaria Yachts. It has 5 cabins and room for up to 11 people. It has a platform at the back to dive from. At the site of the blast, the Baltic Sea is about 80 meters deep, requiring specialist diving skills and specialist air tanks, one with a helium-oxygen mixture and one with pure oxygen, the Spiegel report said. Each dive would have required the boat to be over the pipeline for about 3 hours. To have laid explosives on 2 pipelines 4 kilometers apart would probably have required 4 dives over a period of a few days. Diving experts say such extended deep dives would have required a decompression chamber for the divers, which would not fit on a small yacht. There are also questions on whether there would be room for the required explosives. The Danish and Swedish governments have said that the blasts were equivalent to the power of several hundred kilograms of explosives. Some experts say up to 2,000 kilograms would have been needed. We have been presented a piece of a puzzle. However, we don't know how big the puzzle is. It is 50 pieces, 500 or 5,000 pieces, said Christian Molling, the head of the Center for Security and Defense at the German Council on Foreign Relations. Was there a second boat and did somebody transport the explosives from somewhere else? Christian Molling asked. So that's why I think there are pieces of the puzzle missing for the moment. The chair of the Bundestag's Intelligence Oversight Committee, Konstantin von Notz, has warned the press to be as cautious as possible with any conclusions at this point in time. Konstantin von Notz told the German magazine Die Zeit the investigation was very likely to be dealing with a state or quasi-state actor because it is very demanding to transport large quantities of explosives. Up to 2 tons are now being discussed, undetected, to the right place in the Baltic Sea, to transport them into a relevant depth in order to trigger several explosions in a controlled manner. he said a state-backed act of terrorism makes it more likely than false or deceptive clues were laid. The German public prosecutor's office has said that a boat had been searched between 18th and 20th of January over suspicions it could have been used to transport explosive devices that exploded on 26th of September 2022. European and US intelligence officials have obtained tentative intelligence to suggest a pro-Ukrainian saboteur group may have been behind the bombing of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines last year, according to reports in the New York Times and the German newspaper Die Zeit. German newspaper Die Zeit has also covered this story and tells us more. European and US intelligence officials have obtained tentative intelligence to suggest a pro-Ukrainian saboteur group may have been behind the bombing of the Nord Stream 1 and 2 gas pipelines last year, according to reports in the New York Times and the German newspaper Die Zeit. German investigators believe the attack on the pipelines was carried out by a team of six people, including a yacht that had been hired by a company registered in Poland and owned by two Ukrainian citizens, according to the German newspaper Die Zeit. The information has been shared between the European intelligence agencies in an effort to establish more information about those who carried out the undersea bombings in September, an attack that had left Western governments perplexed. Details about the intelligence remaining sketchy, and it is unclear what confidence the US intelligence community places in the theory, as well as who may have organized the effort, funded or directed such a daring attack on the gas pipelines running between Russia and Germany. But it is suggested that the government of Kiev did not direct the underwater strike. Russia says it wanted an independent international inquiry to be set up in response to the report. Its deputy envoy to the United Nations said Moscow would call for a vote at the United Nations Security Council on whether to launch an international investigation. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov on Wednesday, 8th of March, dismissed the US reports as a coordinated effort by the authors of the attack to divert attention. "How can American officials assume anything without an investigation?" said Dmitry Peskov, adding that Russia was still not allowed to be part of the investigation into this monstrous crime. Russia's embassy to the United States said on Wednesday, 8th of March, that leaks from U.S. intelligence services were no more than an attempt to confuse anybody who sincerely wishes to seek out the truth in this flagrant crime. It added, "It is simply a means of shifting suspicion from those in official government positions who ordered and coordinated the attacks in the Baltic Sea on the abstract individuals of some sort." A senior aide to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the government in Kiev was in no way involved in the attack, which he said had no military impact on Russian forces. "In the midst of a war, Ukraine and its allies would definitely not spend resources on something that would not bring us victory directly on the battlefield. It doesn't make any sense, but it is extremely beneficial for Russia itself to try to switch attention from the war and try to present itself as a kind of victim," he said. The attack took place in international waters in the Baltic Sea near the Danish island of Bornholm, with large amounts of gas rising up from the sea floor.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to the program of Viewpoint, and I'm Beta, the host of today's episode. And we have two dear speaker guests here with me, Brother Ali and Brother Muhammad. Welcome, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, in this episode of today, we're going to discuss one of the most controversial issues of Islamic world about Palestinian issue. So, as you know, Palestine is one of the most valuable lands and regions in Islam thoughts and also other religions. So, in this episode, based on the leadership statements, we're going to discuss this issue.
Standing on the rubble of her home, she cries out for her parents.
And everywhere in this world, the people, the youth people, are the next generation of leaders and the next decision makers. And particularly because we are Palestinian, and you know, we have been living under the Israeli occupation for more than 60 years. We have a more pardon in order to lead our nation and to fight for our rights, and also to try to develop the situation that the Palestinian people live in Palestine, in Jordan, in Syria, in Lebanon, which unfortunately is going from worse to worse each day.
The right of return is still the major cornerstone of the Palestinian issue. And as the Palestinians would say, though they don't live in Palestine, Palestine lives in their heart. So for all Palestinians, this is core to the whole issue. A lot of Palestinians do not benefit from the very thing which every other society, every other culture, every other civilization is able to benefit from, which is to pass on the progress and the fruits to their next generation. Palestinians, because of the fact that they are under occupation, because they are living as refugees, they are not able to prosper economically, they are not able to develop as a country, as a state, and as a culture and a civilization.
So, as you told me, there is a special depth in this supporting that we are actually making for Palestinian people. But here, there is another question. As you know, we have many values, we have many beautiful things, but there is still logic here. And we do something for a return, you know. If, for example, we are helping someone, we may expect that person help us in the future too. So, the question which arises here is that if Palestinian people, the place of Palestinian people were upside down, I mean, they were in our situation and we were in their situation, mm-hmm. everything was vice versa, would they help us in a way we are helping them? If yes, what is your special reason that you are telling me that yes, they would help us?
You see, let's consider this an issue from the perspective of Islam.
Yeah.
If they consider themselves as Muslims, they will definitely help us in the other way around. Especially considering that they have gone through the same oppression that we're going through the same oppression that they went through. A person seeing oppression from the human instinct goes against it, mm-hmm. right? When it comes to Islam, it's even further, the person will stand against that. So if you see so many Muslims around the world, not only in Iran is like, it's a government that is going against Israel, but you see so many groups, movements that are not necessarily backed by governments, but they stand because they're Muslims. So many non-Muslims against oppression, right?
Yeah.
If we see this picture, then definitely we can say the same for Palestinians, because Palestinians, among them, they're definitely people who are against oppression. The main fact that they're fighting, they're resisting this oppression on them, gives us the reason, gives us the notion that when they are on the opposite side, from the side of the supporter, they'll definitely support those who are fighting in the field.
Yeah.
Let me add one more point to the explanations of Brother Muhammad. And when we are helping a person who is in need, I mean, let's say a poor, a poor person, a needy person. Actually, we're not expecting something to get back to us. We're not actually expecting a day that he comes and compensate whatever had happened to him.
We have no such intention.
We have no such intention.
But from political viewpoint, we have. We should have, you know.
Even, look, we are looking from an Islamic perspective. This is an Islamic perspective. I mean, we are not expecting something to get back to us. Moreover, when we have Islamic principles and Islamic rulings, and everyone who is dedicated to Islamic rulings, he knows that it's his duty or her duty in this time to support Palestinians, whether he is living in Iran or he's living in another country. So if a person, an intellectual Muslim or a wise person, a wise Muslim, knows Islam well, knows that his duty is to help Palestinians at this time, right now. And we have many cases of Muslims, fortunately, plenty of Muslims, I can say, in different Islamic nations, majority of the people are with helping the Palestinian and are with this notion to help the Palestinian and oppress Palestinians. But the problem is with the government. The problem is with the Muslim leaders that we have, unfortunately, today. They are not representing the Islamic nations. There is, I think we have to differentiate between these two, Islamic nations and Islamic leaders.
Yeah.
Islamic leaders, you might say, okay, these are the people who selected the Islamic leaders. No, it's not like that. A country like Saudi Arabia, are people selecting the government?
No.
Definitely no. So there is a sort of gap between these two, fronts. So, functionally, even if we were in their place, definitely all the Muslims would understand that who is the oppressor and who is the oppressor. And they will do the right, and they would do the needful at the right time, right?
Yeah. So, thank you for your explanation about these. But you are telling me that they would do that as a kind of thing that because they understand they are Muslims too. But what if they're powering enough? I mean, what is our goal here? What are we doing for Palestinian people? The goal of us is the freedom of Palestine or referendum? What do we exactly want here?
Based on our Islamic duties and Islam and humanitarian duties, we are helping the person who is in need, the oppressed one, whether he is, let's say, a Muslim
or a non-Muslim.
Again, it is a good reason to enlighten the hearts of the people who are actually studying about our stances in the scene of the in international arena, to tell them that it's not important for us, for example, that a Muslim is under pressure, or let's say Jew or a Christian. This is the brilliant viewpoint of the leader of the Islamic Ummah that was given to the international arena, that we are after the votes of the people of the Palestine. Either they are from Islamic Ummah, or from Christianity, or from Judaism. So all of the votes are going to work here. So we are not going to deny the rights of the Jews that were there, and their rights, to ignore their rights. The same way is happening in our country. Look, different minorities have their own representatives in our Congress, you see, our parliament. In our parliament. You see, Jews have their representative, Christians have their representatives, and even the Zoroastrians have their own representative in our parliament. So this is what Islam says, the rights of the Muslims. The rights of the Muslims equals the rights of non-Muslims who are living, they are going to live peacefully together. So this is what we are after. We say, okay, just pay attention to the votes and to the voices of the people who have been living there.
And even further than that, I think it's important to understand that now this notion of referendum that is now surfacing the media and the world right now, why didn't they go after referendum at the beginning when they were expediting the entire that country? Why now that the country is in chaos? Why now that the population has been distributed in a way that it comes out to their favor, they're now going to go for referendum? You should have gone for referendum at the beginning. Ask the people, are you ready to give your lands to these Zionists or not? You have to ask from the beginning. Now that you've usurped their lands, removed half their population, and even further than half, you've caused chaos in the region, then you say, okay, let's now discuss about this. This doesn't work like that.
So I got to know that, okay, we have to maintain this human right everywhere, no matter it is Palestine or any other countries. But are we doing the right thing? I mean, what are we doing right now? We are, I don't know, doing a special budget for this issue, or we are claiming that we are supporting them. But what are the actions we are taking, actually? And are they the right actions to support these people?
As our brother Ali mentioned a few moments ago, that first of all, we're not expecting anything in return.
Yeah.
As long as the people get their rightful status and we get our security that is long awaited,
are we getting
happy
it?
With it? Yeah, of course.
We're
in the path. Us, by our resistance, by sponsoring the resistance forces in the region and in Palestine itself, we were able to, you know, remove this, you know, minor cancer, which initiated from the major cancer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you a story. The leader of the Hamas, when they had the meeting with the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, when he returned, he says a very beautiful thing. He says that he thought that at the end of mm-hmm. the discussions, the leader will definitely ask him something from the Palestinian, like, oh, become Shias or whatever it is,
yeah.
right? He said that he had no such intention. He was all in the form of giving, helping them. There was no expectation from the leader. That's how we are. When we look, when we see this path of resistance, of fighting against this cancer and this in the region, we're not expecting anything. That's the first point.
Mm.
So once, as long as according to the ideology of justice, we are in the right path, going against oppression, we're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
No matter how much budget, no matter how much money we set aside in the budget to fight this, as long as it's the right thing, as long as we're in line with the ideology of Islam, then we're doing the right thing.
Let me add a point to this. Actually, we're not fighting for the Palestinians. We're just supporting them.
Yeah, exactly.
We believe that the whole front of disbelief, the whole front of kufr, is supporting Israel. So what is our duty? Our duty is to support Palestinians. They're defending them with everything. With equipment, with even people to be sent there to, kill Muslims. We are just supporting Palestinians. We strengthen them. Yes, we train them. We do send equipment to them. For example, we do send missiles. And we teach them how to make missiles because they need to defend their own rights. We believe that we are not going to go, for example, in the Palestinian fronts to, let's say, fight for the Palestinians. We want them to know themselves, to find them, their own selves, and they fight for their own selves, right? So this is the least thing that we are actually doing, but we are expecting the Islamic world to do so. But unfortunately, they are working on normalization of their ties with Israel. So this is a big, let's say, the big misfortune that we have it in Islamic Ummah, that we have been actually we have been shattered.
Yeah.
That we don't see this unity among the Islamic Ummah. They are expected to help the Palestinians. Yes, some of them say, okay, we sent, we send money for the Palestinians.
Yeah.
What is this money for? They need your support, man. They need your, stance in international. They need your stance in international arena. This is what works for the Palestinians. So we are doing the least help and the least support to the Palestinians to make them strengthen and to make them strong to help to defend themselves.
Thank you, Brother Ali and Brother Muhammad, for your presence in this episode. So we are here standing for these people, helping them, supporting them most of all. The most important thing here is that we're not going to fight behalf of them. We are just supporting them to be free to find themselves, you know, in a way that they should be. So it was all the time we have for today's episode. Thank you, dear brothers and dear listeners, for being here with us. And I bid you farewell and leave you in the warm embrace of Allah. Thank you. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Every day we tell each other that this day will be the last, and tomorrow we all can go home free, and all this will finally end. Palestine, tomorrow. Palestine, tomorrow we'll be free. Father, to wipe away my tears. That's why I will cry. I feel scared, but I won't show my fears. I keep my head high, deep in my heart. I never have any doubt that Palestine, tomorrow will be free. Palestine, tomorrow will be free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
According to political commentators, bilateral relationship between the United States and China has been set towards further deterioration as competition between the two major world powers continues with no end in sight. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. According to internal documents, a senior U.S. Air Force commander warned his subordinates that they should brace for war with China over Taiwan in just 2 years' time. In a memo obtained by the outlet and confirmed by U.S. officials, General Mike Minahan, the head of the Air Mobility Command, claimed that as both the United States and Taiwan will be distracted by their presidential elections in 2024, Beijing will be able to make a move against the self-governed island. The memo said, "I hope I'm wrong. My gut feeling tells me we will fight in 2025. The document is referred to all wing commanders in Air Mobility Command and other Air Force operational commanders and orders them to report on all major efforts related to a potential standoff with China within 1 month. During the month of February, General Mike Minahan directs all AMC personnel to fire a clip into a 7-meter target with a full understanding that unrepentant, lethality matters most, aim for the head. He also orders all personnel to update their records and emergency contacts. U.S. commanders are also urged not to shy away from risk during drills. General Mike Minahan wrote, "If you are comfortable in your approach to training, then you are not taking enough risks," while an AMC spokesperson confirmed the authenticity of the memo. An unnamed Pentagon official told NBC News that these comments are not representative of the department's views on China. Senior U.S. officials have claimed in recent months that they have evidence China is rapidly accelerating its timeline for taking control of Taiwan. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all countries in the world recognize that sovereignty, meaning that they would not establish diplomatic contact with Taiwan's secessionist government. The United States, too, claims commitment to that principle, but in violation of its own stated policy and an attempt to antagonize Beijing, Washington has quartered the secessionist government in Taipei, supporting its anti-China stance and supplying it with large cache of weaponry. Tensions over the self-rule island intensified following a provocative visit there last August by Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House of Representatives at the time. It prompted large-scale Chinese military drills around the island territory, as well as a declaration by U.S. President Joe Biden to defend Taiwan. Beijing says the issue of Chinese Taipei is a red line that must not be crossed. In October, China's President Xi Jinping stated that although Beijing seeks peaceful reunification with Taiwan, it will never promise to give up the use of force and reserves the option to take all necessary measures to achieve this goal. The Fox News Channel has also covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Republican Congressman Michael McCaul has said that with the Democratic President Joe Biden in the White House, the risk of a conflict between China and Taiwan is very high. Congressman Michael McCaul added that the U.S. military is not ready to fight a war with China, and it could run out of precision missiles and advanced technology in less than a week if war breaks out. Congressman Michael McCaul said on Sunday, 29th of January, "We have to be prepared for this, and it could happen, I think, as long as Joe Biden is in office, projecting weakness as he did with Afghanistan that led to Russia to start its special operation in Ukraine, that the odds are very high we could see a conflict with China and Taiwan and the Indo-Pacific." Michael McCaul also said the U.S. could run out of advanced weaponry in less than a week if the United States launched a war with China. A study published by a think tank last week found that the United States would likely run out of some of its munitions, including long-range precision-guided ones, in less than a week if war breaks out with China. The Center for Strategic and International Studies study said that the United States was not adequately prepared for a war with China. The think tank said in its report, "The U.S. defense industrial base is not adequately prepared for the competitive security environment that now exists. It is currently operating at a tempo better suited to a peacetime environment." According to the report, the U.S. military aid to Ukraine has depleted the arms stockpiles of the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon, and points to the difficulties the United States industrial base could face in supplying munitions for a major war. Michael McCaul lamented, "Our industrial defense base is broken. I signed off on all foreign military weapons sales 3 years ago. They have yet to go into Taiwan. We need that deterrence, but if we don't have the weapons, that's as critical for deterrence." Washington is Taiwan's most important international backer and arms supplier, despite the absence of formal diplomatic relations. U.S. arms sales to Taiwan are a constant irritant to Beijing's relations with Washington, which have rapidly deteriorated in recent years. The Washington Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The newly elected Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, plans to travel to Chinese Taipei in what would renew tensions with China. Media reports say recently the U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, was preparing for Kevin McCarthy's visit to Taipei this spring. If McCarthy goes on to travel to Taipei, it would be the second trip to the self-ruled island by U.S. House Speaker in less than a year, sparking almost back-to-back escalation with China, which has sovereignty over Taipei. Former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan in August of last year, bypassing Beijing diplomatically and establishing direct contact with Taipei to plan the trip. That visit angered China, which issued statements critical of Nancy Pelosi and the U.S. and staged large military exercises in waters near the island to assert its sovereignty. Tensions in the Taiwan Strait reached levels not seen in three decades, with live fire drills in several areas around the island. Kevin McCarthy's possible visit could also waste any gains from a meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping at the Group of 20 summit last November, which was intended to pave the way for improved relations between the two nations after Nancy Pelosi's visit. International relations analyst with Eurasia Group told media that news of Kevin McCarthy's visit to Chinese Taipei was no surprise because the new House Speaker would want to maintain domestic political legitimacy in the face of bipartisan support for aggressive policy towards China. While the Biden administration had reservations about Nancy Pelosi's trip before it took place, the administration ultimately decided against forestalling it. However, analysts at the Eurasia Group agreed that a second official visit by a U.S. House Speaker does represent an escalation of what Beijing sees as U.S. interference in cross-strait affairs, even though Kevin McCarthy, a Republican, may not be seen as representing official White House policy.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.